You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Welcome to Radical Australian Community Radio 3CR, streaming live on 3cr.org.au. We have a guest, a live guest in the studio. Now, Daryl, how have you been, young man?
Oh, Todd, really good.
What's it like being an old age pensioner, mate?
Well, surprisingly, it's really good. You know? It's,
right? So you recommend
life is so much better.
You recommend it, do you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I recommend everyone get old.
Right. Now, our guest today on Radical Australia is Eve Scarfe. Is that correct?
Yes, indeed.
And how do you pronounce scarf? How do you spell scarf?
S-C-A-R-F-E.
Ah, with
what
an E.
What do I do when I cough?
Ah, it's all right. You can cough. Daryl kind of hides the coughs. That's his job. He makes us look professional. Now, Eve, I know I shouldn't ask you this, but I can't help myself. What year were you born?
I was born in 1940.
40,
yes.
So you were a war baby?
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Yes, I was born in Cairo, Egypt, which was then a kind of a British protectorate.
Right.
And Britain had a very big military garrison there.
Right.
My father was in the army.
Right.
But the war was sufficiently far away that military personnel were still allowed to have their families with them.
Right.
Which is why my mother was there with him, and why I was born in the Anglo-American hospital on Gezira Island,
right,
which they say was the very spot where Moses was found in the bulrushes.
Oh, right.
That's what they used to say.
That's what they used to say. And did you have any, you got any brothers and sisters or have?
Yes, I was the eldest of four.
Right.
I have two sisters and I had a brother who was the youngest of the family, but he was killed in a sporting accident a bit over a year ago.
In a sporting accident?
Yes. He was a rock climber.
Oh, right, right.
Very dangerous sport.
It is a very dangerous sport, especially he wouldn't have been a young man, would he?
No, he was 69.
69. And what were your parents like?
What were they like?
As parents.
Oh, they were good parents. Yes. They were good, affectionate parents.
Right.
Yes, indeed. And my father was Irish,
right,
but his career was in the British Army,
mm-hmm,
which wasn't so surprising at that period as it might have seemed. My mother was English, and they had met as students at Oxford.
At Oxford?
Yes.
What were they doing at Oxford?
What were they doing at Oxford? Studying.
I know, but what were they studying?
My father was studying history,
right,
and my mother was studying, I think, something like social work.
Social work.
It wasn't called that then, but that was what it mainly
is.
It more or less qualified her to be a social worker.
So did they spend the war, did your mother and the children spend the war in Egypt, or were you evacuated back to Britain?
Six months after I was born, the war was getting closer.
Mm.
Rommel had taken charge,
right,
and he was advancing across North Africa. And it was feared that Cairo might, and the British garrison there might soon be in the firing line.
Right.
So they put all the family members of British service people,
mm-hmm,
on a troop ship, and they shipped us all to South Africa.
To South Africa?
Yes.
And how long were you there for?
Oh, about another year.
Another year. So you'd have no recollections?
No recollection whatsoever. No recollection whatsoever. No.
And then what, back to Britain?
And then back to Britain,
mm-hmm,
and spent the war years, my earliest recollections, my early childhood, in Ireland, in the countryside, on the family farm,
right,
with my paternal grandparents.
Right, and obviously Ireland actually wasn't involved in the war.
No, it was neutral.
Neutral, yeah. So what was life like? So how long did you spend in Ireland? How much time did you spend in Ireland as a young person?
I spent my first 5 or 6 years.
Right.
And I also spent about a year when I was eight.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the one what you would call stable point
right.
in my younger life.
Mm-hmm.
Because my grandparents were there on the family farm, and my father, because of his military career, would move around a lot.
Right.
We lived in almost every county in England
right.
for various periods of time.
Right.
At the time when my father retired from the army, mm-hmm. my mother said that she hadn't lived 2 whole years in one house during the whole time of her married life.
Right. And how old was he when he retired? Roughly, yeah.
Oh, I think he was something short of 60.
So for about...
There was a chance to get out with a golden handshake.
Yes.
Because the British government was reducing the size of its army.
Right. So how did that affect your education, having to move all the time?
Well, I went to 11 different schools, but only 2 secondary schools. And the first of those was in Gibraltar, which was one of the places that my father was stationed in,
mm-hmm.
a big British garrison there. And that was absolutely determining of my future life.
Why?
Because I learnt Spanish.
You learnt Spanish in Gibraltar.
And if I hadn't learnt Spanish, I wouldn't have been studying Spanish at Oxford.
Right.
I wouldn't have met my husband,
mm-hmm.
my future husband, who was a fellow student, also studying Spanish. I wouldn't have gone to Australia because that was his decision.
Right.
And I wouldn't have gone to Latin America.
Right.
Much later in life.
Well, let's go back a few steps, all right? So you were studying Spanish at Oxford?
Yes.
Why?
Because I'd already learnt it. Because
right.
I'd already learnt it. You needed to have a good... To be accepted, you had
right.
to, you were not you didn't go to Oxford to learn Spanish,
right?
Because you had to have already a good grasp of the language.
Right. So did you do your
did advanced translation?
Mm-hmm. So did you do your schooling in Gibraltar in Spanish, or was that just
no? But we had Spanish classes.
You had Spanish,
and
classes.
I can remember an elderly nun called Mother Hildegard,
yes.
who used to drill us for 10 minutes at the start of every class on the irregular verbs.
On the irregular.
So my Spanish was, in fact, very correct.
Correct. I like that.
Especially as far as irregular verbs are concerned.
Very good. And you've kept that up.
I have, yes, because I've got many Spanish contacts and I spend a lot of time talking to them.
Now, you said your future husband was also learning Spanish.
Well, studying Spanish.
Sorry, yes. My apologies. That's right. You told us you've got to learn Spanish before you go to Oxford.
Yes.
And then
you study literature.
Why was he studying Spanish literature? It seems a bit esoteric. His
father was an academic in French.
Right.
For which reason he hated French.
Right.
And he turned to Spanish,
right.
which his father disliked,
uh-huh.
as a sort of form of, I think, originally teenage rebellion.
Yes, yes.
He'd gone to Spain, he'd learnt Spanish.
Right, right.
And in fact, he was living in Spain when he died 3 weeks ago.
Oh,
yes.
That's very...
We'd been divorced for many years, but mm-hmm. we were still on good terms.
Well, that's good.
So I was sad about that.
Yes, it's understandable. How old were you when you got married? What year was it?
I was 19.
What year?
1969, it must have been.
69.
Or it may have been 68, because I turned 19 in 69,
right.
and I can't remember in which month we got married.
Right. And did you have any children?
Yes, I've had 3 children.
Right. Are they all with us?
One is dead,
mm-hmm.
and 2 are alive.
Right.
Currently in Spain, wrapping up their father's affairs.
Affairs, right. So what did you graduate with from Oxford?
I didn't graduate.
You didn't graduate?
Because by getting married,
right.
I wasn't allowed to graduate.
You weren't allowed to graduate?
No.
Because you got married?
Because I got married, yes.
Right.
You weren't allowed to graduate. You got married, or if you got pregnant,
right.
regardless of in which order you did these things.
Things, right.
I mean. And things changed only a few years later,
right.
as I discovered, when I, 10 years later, made a visit back.
Right.
Things changed a lot, but I actually finally graduated from La Trobe University.
Right.
After we'd moved to Australia.
So, after you got married, where did you live?
We lived for a while in great difficulty in lodgings.
Right.
In Oxford.
Mm-hmm.
And that may have been what decided us after my husband, my then husband, had graduated.
Mm-hmm.
he decided, let's go to Australia.
Right.
Well, in those days, if your husband decided, let's go to Australia, wife came along.
Was there any discussion about this decision?
Well, I wasn't keen, and all my family members and all his family members were saying, you'll hate it.
You'll hate it.
It's a terribly uncultured place.
Yes, yes.
That's what they were saying.
Yes, that's it.
So, not that we were particularly cultured, I suppose, except that we had some knowledge of Spanish literature, which wasn't terribly practical in Australia.
No, it's not very practical, is it?
Moment. No.
You're not a 10-pound pom, are you?
Well, we tried to be.
You tried to be, and you were rejected.
But my husband had asthma.
Oh, right.
Yes, Bruno, his name. Bruno had asthma.
Right.
So he didn't pass the medical. So we had to pay our own way.
You paid your own way to come here, to this horrible place.
Well, when we arrived, I liked it more than he did.
Right.
I liked it a lot, actually.
Where did you arrive?
We arrived in Fremantle in 1962.
And did you stay in Fremantle?
And we lived in Perth for 5 years.
Right. And what did you do for a crust?
He had already fixed up a job as a French teacher.
A French teacher?
Yes. It's ironic, wasn't it?
It's so ironic. He goes on a little revolution as a teenager and then
he ends up as a French teacher.
What did his father say about that?
I think his father was a bit upset about the whole business.
The whole business, right.
Anyway, his father never came to visit us.
Right.
My parents, at one stage, did come to visit us.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't living in Perth by then. We were living in Victoria.
Right.
Because he got a job at La Trobe University.
Ah, and what was he, a lecturer?
A lecturer in Spanish.
Right.
Yes.
Well, that's good.
So he was much happier with that.
Right.
But he eventually got sick of that.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave up his job and he moved to the country and set up a bookshop.
A bookshop?
Yes.
Where was that?
In Foster.
In Foster.
And then
Did you go bankrupt setting up a bookshop in Foster?
Well, he had a few savings.
Yes.
He didn't make a big income,
no.
But he managed to live.
Right.
And then as Booksellers Bulletin or newsletter,
yes,
which published an occasional article about him, this terribly eccentric person.
Right.
Trying to make a living selling books in Foster.
Oh, I agree with them.
As they commented, he has now set himself an even more impossible task. He's moved to Omeo.
Omeo.
And he proposes to sell books in Omeo.
That's extraordinary, selling books in Omeo.
So he sold books in Omeo.
One a day, I reckon.
I think he did rather better in Omeo than in Foster.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, Omeo's in those days would have been out of the way, and obviously people needed something to keep them occupied.
Beautiful place, Omeo.
Mm.
Do you know, in all this time, we were sort of semi-separated, but I used to visit him on weekends now and then.
Right. What do you mean you were semi-separated? Were you going your own lives?
Because I stayed in Melbourne.
Right.
He didn't really encourage me to go with him.
Right.
It wasn't a case of, will you come with me? It was a case of, would you be very upset if I went?
Right.
Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, I understand. So, and what, you were responsible for the children or?
The children, yes, the children were at that time, I think, still at school.
Yes.
And then going on to university.
University, so. Right, so how long did you last in Melbourne?
I lasted in Melbourne until 1988.
1988.
Which is when I went to Latin America.
Excuse me. I'm a little bit confused here. You're in Melbourne until 1988, and all of a sudden you wanted to go to Latin America. What's going on? What happened?
I'd become more and more interested in social questions.
Right.
More and more concerned about the way things were going.
Yes.
More and more concerned about what I was hearing about Latin America.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people I knew were involved in solidarity activities.
Right.
In fact, most Australians that I knew that were involved in solidarity activities were in solidarity with the Philippines.
Right, yes.
But I tended towards Central America because everything seemed to be happening there and because I spoke Spanish.
Right. So when you say everything was happening in Central America in the late 80s, what do you mean by that?
Well, a revolutionary movement had won in Nicaragua,
mm-hmm.
had taken over the government, and was now being pressured very, very seriously by a US-financed and organized war in which they recruited refugees,
yes.
people who had left because they didn't like the change in government,
right.
people who'd been part of the old government,
mm-hmm.
particularly part of its National Guard, which yes. had rather a bad reputation.
Mm.
And the US government financed and organized these people to make war.
Right. So did you go as an individual or part of an organization?
But at the same time, similar things were happening in El Salvador
right.
and in Guatemala.
Right. Did you go as an individual or were you part of an organized movement?
I went as an individual.
That's quite. That's quite. That's quite brave.
Well, I don't know about brave. It was more a matter of curiosity, excitement.
Right. Right.
I planned to go just for a year.
Yes.
I took a year leave without pay for the from the public service that
right.
I was working in at that time,
mm-hmm.
at the Midway Migrant Center.
Right.
Running programs for newly arrived refugees, actually.
And how long did you do that for? Running programs.
I'd done that for about 8 years.
About 8 years.
Yes.
I mean, it's not the type of thing you'd expect. If you were born in 1940, so you're in your late 40s.
Yes.
It's not the type of thing you expect somebody to do just to get up and go to Central America.
Well, maybe it's not the kind of thing you expect.
Yes.
It's what I did. I was inspired, basically, by the solidarity movement in Melbourne, having invited people from organisations in Central America
right.
to come and talk about their cause.
Could you tell us something about the solidarity movement during that period?
Oh, how can I describe
well,
it?
Well, how was it a loose organisation?
There were a whole lot of different organisations.
Right.
And it was actually rather a problem, the division, the number of Central America organisations that there were.
Mm-hmm.
I took part in two, Latin American Information Centre and CISCAC. Christians in Solidarity
right.
with Central America.
Right.
And with CISCAC, we did my first bit of direct action,
right.
where we did a sit-in on the floor of the US consulate
down
in Melbourne.
In St Kilda Row.
Yes.
Yes.
It would have been more relevant to have done it at the embassy in Canberra.
Right.
But we didn't have the money to go to Canberra,
right.
and I had my family was still quite young,
young
so I
yeah.
couldn't really take off.
Right. So were you arrested?
We were arrested.
Mm.
We sat on the floor, and we spread first a sheet of plastic because we didn't want to be accused of vandalising their carpet.
Oh,
we
right.
wanted to be arrested for trespass,
oh, right.
not for vandalism.
Right, right.
On that, we put a map of Central America, and on that, we poured a bottle of blood.
Right.
It was our blood.
Right.
And it had been very hygienically and correctly extracted by a member of our group who was a nurse.
Right. I actually remember that. I remember that.
Did you hear of it?
Of course.
Good Lord.
Yeah. Well, so, look, I'm almost as old as you are.
Look,
I was born 10 years earlier. You know, 10 years later, I should say. So that was one of... Because I do remember Solidarity and they
yes.
were exceptionally
yes.
involved in...
Yes.
In campaigns against the military dictatorship in the Philippines, the Marcos regime.
Yes.
And it's quite ironical that his son's now president and elected by the people of the Philippines.
Absolutely.
And
Marcos and Imelda.
Yes, yes.
Ferdinand and Imelda.
Yeah, yeah.
And Imelda's, what was it, 1,000 pair of shoes?
That's
she had?
Right, yes, yes. And she's got them back. So where did you land in Central America?
I aimed to go to El Salvador.
Mm-hmm.
That was my objective.
Right.
That was the country that interested me most.
Right.
But I went on a sort of circuitous journey. I visited Guatemala and Honduras first.
Right. And what did you see in Guatemala and Honduras that sticks in your mind?
At that time, I wasn't very interested in Guatemala.
Right.
I only visited Guatemala City.
Right.
I wasn't very interested. It was only much later that I got to know Guatemala very well, and in fact it's the country in Latin America where I've spent most time.
Right.
Honduras, I had some interesting experiences. I had the first time I ever met the mother of somebody who had disappeared.
Mm.
There were many more of these cases in Guatemala and in El Salvador, and there were organizations of mothers of the disappeared. I was introduced to this mother.
Mm-hmm.
She told me about what the experience was, right, her pain, and so on.
So, a lot of people won't remember this period, but what did it mean that people disappeared?
It meant normally that they were captured by the secret police or the army. Police and army were pretty much interchangeable in what they did in these countries, which were all dictatorships.
And they're all support.
Either clearly, obviously, dictatorships,
yes,
or de facto dictatorships, because even though they had a democratic government on the surface, the real power was in the army.
Right.
And also, I was travelling with...
So what would happen is if they had political opponents, whether reformists, trade unionists,
yes,
or anybody stood
they
up...
They would be disappeared. And they would be arrested, arrested...
And executed.
And eventually killed.
Yeah, yes.
Eventually.
Yeah.
Mm. And what this...
And a lot of this was actually supported by the US at that particular point in time.
Yes. In all these countries.
Yes.
In some cases, more blatantly. In other cases, less so.
Mm-hmm.
In El Salvador, very blatantly.
So tell us about your experiences in El Salvador. By this time, were you still working as an individual, or had you joined any organisation?
I arrived in El Salvador as an individual,
mm-hmm,
but early on, in say even in the first weeks of my time there, I met people who seemed to be doing the kind of things that I was starting to do and wanted to do,
mm-hmm,
which was to be with the people who were working in people's organisations, whether trade unions or refugee and displaced people's organisations or environmental organisations or whatever, or all kinds of people's organisations,
mm-hmm,
in countries in which there was a full-scale guerrilla war going on.
Right.
And I very quickly met people who were doing this, but in an organised way. And these people were members of a Peace Brigades team.
Right.
Peace Brigades International was a fairly young organisation. It's still going.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still doing committee work for it.
Right.
I've got a meeting next week.
Oh, excellent.
Yes. Online.
Online.
Yes.
So, Peace Brigade International.
Yes.
So, what was the function, or what is their function?
Their function was to provide some protection,
right,
for people working in human rights,
mm-hmm,
in countries where people who did that were under persecution and repression. Mainly, the form of work for which they're most known is called protective accompaniment.
What does that mean?
That means being alongside a person or an organisation, mostly an organisation, and doing what they feel they need. In El Salvador, we used to do a day shift or a night shift, and during the day shift, we would either sit in the office all day,
mm-hmm,
and just be there, or we would accompany, say, the president, the coordinator, or the secretary,
right,
of the organisation on their rounds of visits. We would never go into the meetings with them. We'd just accompany them and stay outside the meeting.
Right.
Because one of the principles of Peace Brigades is non-interference.
But this is very dangerous. This is exceptionally dangerous. If people are disappearing left, right and centre, how did you deal with that pressure?
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
Well, I very soon had the opportunity to join Peace Brigades.
Mm-hmm.
In those days, when everything was fairly new, it was very much more informal than it is now.
Right.
To join a fieldwork team now is quite a process.
Right.
But then they just said, look, we've got a vacancy.
Right.
Because one of our people has just been expelled from the country.
Right.
Because he'd been caught in the wrong place at the wrong time twice in the same month.
Right.
he was Swedish, and the Swedish consul said, send him out of the country now because we won't be responsible for him anymore. Mm. Twice is enough. We won't be responsible for him anymore if he gets arrested again.
So were most members in El Salvador of the Peace Brigade International, were they Europeans?
Europeans. There was one Latin American.
Mm-hmm.
There were several people from the United States.
Right.
There was a Canadian.
Right.
A whole mixture.
A whole mixture.
We reckoned that the more different nationalities in the team, the better. Because our accompaniment was not just sitting in someone's office or going on their rounds with them. It was also political accompaniment, by which we meant advocacy.
Right.
And informational accompaniment, which meant spreading information about the situation.
Right. And how did you do that?
Through bulletins, through information to the support base that we had, mainly in Europe.
Right.
And the advocacy was talking to embassies in the country where we were. Later on, when everything became a bit more legally defined, we were able to do advocacy to the authorities in the country. And Peace Brigades nowadays does a lot of advocacy to the authorities of the country where the field team is working.
Right.
Expressing, we use a very polite Peace Brigade's language.
Right.
We don't say we denounce.
Right.
We say we express our concerns.
So the idea was that if you had somebody from a foreign country, especially a Western country, there, that the person would be less likely to disappear and be executed.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. The idea was deterrence.
Deterrence.
That if there is an international observer, either present or liable to pop up at any time, they may cause a scandal, and the people who might be intending to do harm might decide that it wasn't worth the trouble.
Not worth the effort,
Worth the effort, that it might be more of a nuisance than it was worth to do that harm, so they might not do it.
Because
that was the theory.
Because political executions and disappearances were an everyday occurrence in El Salvador during that period.
Indeed.
How many people are talking? El Salvador is not a big place, is it?
No.
Only a few million people, is it?
Yes.
And people were talking about, 30,000 people disappeared during that period?
Something like that.
So just an extraordinary number.
Yes.
Extraordinary number. Did you feel unsafe at any time doing this type of work?
No, I didn't feel unsafe. Although one could be walking down a street and find that that by turning the corner one was in a firefight.
Right.
So one would duck into a shop and it was over. There was something that amused me.
Right.
Listening to talkback radio one day.
Yes.
And the talkback person said, "Please don't keep ringing us to tell us that there is a combat going on in such and such a suburb."
Right.
"Because we've sent reporters out there and they found that it was only a gentleman celebrating his birthday with crackers at a Chinese restaurant."
Right.
So even the locals couldn't necessarily tell what was a firefight and what was something different.
I assume there wasn't an Australian ambassador in El Salvador?
There wasn't an Australian ambassador.
So what, the British ambassador?
The British, yes.
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 And did you have any interaction?
And I actually have a British passport.
Right, so you're a British citizen.
Yes.
Did you have any interaction with them?
Only did we? Yes, we used to come and tell them about our concerns.
Right.
We didn't at that stage. Peace Brigades hadn't progressed to the stage where it was possible to talk to the Salvadoran government and express our concerns to them, but we could express our concerns to our embassy.
Now, how long did you stay in El Salvador?
I was about a year and a half there.
And then what, you went to Guatemala after that?
After that, it became impossible for me to stay.
Why?
A mugshot of me, the time I was arrested,
right,
was published with the caption, "Mercenary."
mercenary.
You're which is a not a nice thing to be called.
Especially when you're a 50-year-old woman. Mercenary, shoot yes. on sight.
Something basically. Like that.
Yes.
And anyway.
You haven't, you're still, somebody, you haven't got that mugshot, have you?
I do, actually.
Oh, yes. That's wonderful.
Yes.
I'm Daryl. Daryl, you reckon if we got a hold of that mugshot, we could put it up on the podcast?
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
You could. Yes.
I could email it to you.
Yeah, it'd be great. After the program, have a chat to Daryl. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I think people, you know, look, this is really dangerous work. What got you to do this? I don't understand the psychology. Were you part of your dad?
I called it the year of living dangerously. It was the most fascinating year of my life.
Really?
Yes.
All right.
Absolutely, without exception.
So they let you out of El Salvador.
So eventually, when we had started a legalizing process,
yes.
with the help of the lawyer from the Lutheran Church,
mm-hmm.
who was our lawyer too, and the Lutheran Church had asked him to help us in this. And we got an interview, all of us who were in the team at that time, with the Minister for Immigration.
Right.
And we went and we had a nice little talk.
Right.
And then he went sort of behind the scenes to talk to somebody else.
Yes.
And he came out brandishing a newspaper clipping with the mugshot.
With the mugshot of the mercenary.
And he said, this lady, this senora, we're not going to give her one day more.
Right.
She should get out of the country tomorrow.
Right. And did they pay you fair?
No, they didn't. No, they weren't in the. They weren't, as we used to put it, you could be cordially invited to leave the country.
You were cordially invited. And if you didn't leave, you'd disappear, basically.
Well, foreigners weren't apt to disappear.
Right.
It was something that didn't happen for the very reason that having a foreigner hanging around a local organisation had deterrence.
Yes.
We carried our deterrence with us. If really serious harm came to us, it would be embarrassing.
Right.
It might cause trouble.
Mm-hmm.
It might be more trouble than it was worth.
Yeah.
Much as they might like to do some harm, they realised it would be more trouble than it was worth. So they refrained from doing it.
Look, I'm a little bit confused. Your dad's in the military.
Yes.
For at least 40 years or 35, 40 years. Was there a radical background?
Radical background.
None whatsoever.
My family was extremely conservative.
So you were radicalised, as they say.
I became radicalised.
Yes.
In Australia.
In Australia.
Yes. Through the solidarity movements.
Well, we're very pleased you did. So when you left El Salvador, did you go straight to Guatemala or did you come back to Australia?
I actually went to Mexico.
To Mexico, right.
And I was looking for a job which might get me back into El Salvador.
Right.
And I looked in vain.
Mm-hmm.
I got an offer of a job translating for a Guatemalan periodical.
Right.
But at that time, I wasn't that thrilled with Guatemala.
Right.
I became very fond of Guatemala later on.
Right.
Then two friends who'd been on the same team as me in El Salvador and who'd left because they'd finished the time that they'd planned to be there,
right.
which was usually a year,
mm-hmm.
they turned up and they said, look, Eva, that's Eve in Spanish.
Yes.
Eva, we've got this idea. We've got some connections. We've got some introductions to relevant people and we want to go and work with Guatemalan refugees.
Mm-hmm.
In southern Mexico, where there are refugee camps of Guatemalans who've had to flee the country because of the persecution and repression going on there.
Right.
And I said, oh, no, I don't think so. Not Guatemalans. Not refugees.
Right.
I was thinking I've worked with refugees before.
Right.
And I'm mainly interested in struggles that are going on.
Right.
And they said, oh, Eva, but it's not what you think. This is very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
These are organised refugees. They're organised politically.
Mm-hmm.
And they're organised to go back to Guatemala in an organised fashion and in an organised way take part in the struggle of civil society to get respect, which it hasn't been getting much of.
Right.
And so we did. We went to Guatemala. We worked in refugee camps. I got to know Guatemalans very different from those I'd ever met before. These were indigenous Guatemalans.
Right.
About half of the Guatemalan population is indigenous. Guatemala and Bolivia are the two most, with the highest proportion of indigenous people in their population in Latin America. And they were all people who spoke different Mayan languages, different languages of the Mayan language family.
Mm-hmm.
And getting to know them and getting to know the way in which they speak Spanish, which is influenced by their mother tongue. Really amazing experience and a wonderful experience. And we really enjoyed it.
Right. So you worked in refugee camps.
We worked in refugee camps.
You weren't in the protection industry, is that?
Not in the protection industry at that stage.
Right.
Though, during that time, towards the end of that time, I had the amazing and wonderful opportunity to accompany the first return, the first organized return of the refugees to Guatemala.
Right.
This had been a question of political word warfare for many months, and between the Guatemalan government and the Mexican government and the United Nations High Commission for Refugees and the leaders of the refugee return movement.
Mm-hmm.
Because some of the work that we were doing actually was with a women's organization, an organization which at that particular time was working particularly to make sure that not only the man of the family, but the woman of the family also got consulted as to whether they wanted to go or to stay.
Mm.
And that they should, and that their comforts and their needs should be taken into account when planning the journey.
Right.
And I had this amazing experience of accompanying the very first movement, which we went by a long way because we were actually quite near the place where we were heading for, if we'd gone by back roads. But the refugees refused. They said for their safety, they needed for everyone in Guatemala to see them and for maximum publicity. If they went by the back roads, they would then be at the mercy of whatever military might be around, and this would be completely unsafe for them. And they finally, after a war of words with all those organizations that weren't in agreement, they got their way.
Mm-hmm.
And we traveled right round Guatemala, right round the country, basically. Right.
Now, Guatemala isn't
not a very big country.
It's not very big.
Bigger
is
than
it?
El Salvador, but not very big.
Right.
None of those Central American countries.
And what was the reception they were receiving as they traveled?
Amazing reception.
Mm.
Yes, in the countryside, shepherdesses looking after their flocks would come to the roadside and wave their handkerchiefs.
Right.
In the towns, huge gatherings would receive the buses that were bringing the refugees. And when they had a day's rest in the capital, they spent the day in the main plaza, the main square of the capital, and being interviewed by all the different organs of the press, being interviewed by all the organizations, getting maximum publicity, which was what they reckoned. Their strategy was that was what they needed for their security in the future.
Mm.
And then finally we arrived at a patch of bush, which was where they were planning to set up a new village community, which eventually flourished and became known as Victoria 20th of January, because 20th of January was the day that they came out from Guatemala.
Right.
And it was to arrive there when everyone had said it was impossible. And there we were. And to see the first efforts of putting up first structures of just a few poles and a lot of black plastic to make coverings, roof and walls for people to sleep under. And then people starting to make their own houses.
Right.
I didn't want to go back. But I was getting messages from the organization I worked for back in Mexico saying, and we're talking about the extreme south of Mexico, quite near the border, saying, you've got to come back. Look, we've got workshops here and we've got workshops there. And, you know, you've got a job to do. You've got to come back.
So you were being paid, were you?
Yes.
Right.
One of the few times that I was actually being paid.
Paid, right.
A lot of times I was receiving my board and lodging.
Right.
In return for things that I did or for my presence being there.
Right.
So I went back. During that year, there were more returns, more and more returns, some more returns to that same place and more returns to other places, mainly in the same area, but also starting to be in some other areas because there were refugees who actually had come from different areas.
Mm.
And basically they wanted to go back to their home area
right.
where they knew, for example, what the climate was like, what the soil was like. They were going to practice agriculture again, so that it was very helpful for them to be in an area they knew because they knew what would grow well there and how they best needed to cultivate and fertilise.
So this was the end of the Civil War, was it, that had dragged on for a number of years?
The Civil War was still going, but there were peace talks.
Right.
Peace talks had started.
Right.
Peace talks started in El Salvador, and the war ended in El Salvador, but the last country in the area to have peace talks was Guatemala.
And when did those peace talks end, the conflict kind of?
Ooh, do you know, I'm terribly bad on
this. No. Was it in the 20th century or the 21st, the early 21st century?
It would have been in either in the 1990s
right.
or in the... No, it must have been in the 1990s, the late 90s.
Late 90s. So yes. How long did you spend in Guatemala?
Well, I was there from... I returned from... Let's see now. Sorry.
No, that's all right. No, I'm just wondering...
You could tidy this up.
No. What I'm saying...
I'm just thinking...
We are going live, so don't worry about it. It's okay. It's a live interview, so it's fine. You've got an extraordinary story to tell. So how many... When was the last time... Did you spend a decade in Guatemala?
Yes, I'd say so.
A decade.
Then in 2000, I went to Colombia.
Colombia?
Yes, I spent about 2 years. But, and then I was in Guatemala again.
But there was another civil war in Colombia.
There was.
I mean, you'd gone from civil war to civil war to civil war. What's wrong with you, Eve? Or Eva, I should say.
Well, I must tell you about an amazing experience I had.
Yes, tell us about it.
After working with the refugees... I got an offer to go and work with an organisation called the CPRs, the CEPERE, which meant the Communities of Population in Resistance.
Right.
And these were groups of people who came from basically the same population as the refugees did. So they were the same kind of people, but indigenous Guatemalans of the same ethnic groups.
Right.
But they had never fled across the border. They had remained hiding in the rainforest.
Right.
And they had managed to survive. And when I came to first, they said, you've got to come and visit because you have to see whether you can put up with the conditions.
Right.
And we have to see whether we think we could work with you.
Mm-hmm.
So I went and I absolutely fell in love with the place and the way of life. And fortunately, they accepted me.
Right. How long did you stay with that community?
I stayed with that community for 5 years.
5 years.
And I lived with them an evolution from a stage when they had no contact with officialdom at all, and in fact were still evading conflict. And they're inviting accompaniers to come and accompany them and inviting me to come and give workshops on the constitution and on the what is it called, the International Declaration of Human Rights.
Yes.
Exactly. So that, because they said in the future, we're not going to run away when the army comes near. Instead, we're going to face them with the Constitution in the hand.
Right.
And in fact, the only person I know of the people who did these workshops with me, whoever met the army, he met them. They were near his village. He met them when he was coming back from work and he didn't have his constitution in his pocket.
Right.
When he was coming back from working in the fields.
Yes.
But he managed to speak to them to such good effect that they agreed not to go into his village.
Right. So what did the children think about their mum wandering around South America, going from civil war to civil war?
Well, before I left, my children had been grown up.
Right.
And with
parents. I know they're grown up. They still care about their mum.
Well, I think they cared. They cared. Yes, I did. I used to go back about once every few years.
Yes.
And see the family.
Right.
But I lived, these people, the communities of population in resistance, I lived with them for 5 years, in which time they moved from having had no connection at all with officialdom to having one of their historic leaders elected as municipal mayor of the municipality.
Right.
And in fact, he was elected twice running.
And this is in position. This is in Guatemala.
In Guatemala.
Right.
Yes, in Guatemala.
So when did you decide that to hang up the shingle as an international peace brigader and come back to Australia? Must have been a big letdown coming back to this place.
I'd been working in Colombia,
right,
which we haven't talked about.
No.
I think we probably don't have time.
Tell us about Colombia. We've got time.
Colombia, I was with peace brigades in Colombia, and I was without peace brigades in Colombia, because in the amount of time I was in the region, you can do quite a lot of things.
Mm.
You can work for a big international organization, and you can work for small local organizations, which is what I mainly did in Guatemala.
Mm.
But in Colombia, I had a very interesting experience with peace brigades when we went on an accompaniment, accompanying a non-government organization,
right,
which had projects in that area, to a part of the countryside where at that time the guerrilla movement, which in that there were several in Colombia, but the particular one in that area was the FARC.
FARC, yes.
Which was the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, FARC. Yes, and they had a much more visible presence there than anything that we'd seen in any other part of Colombia where we'd worked. And there was, first of all, we were traveling by boat. We weren't using Peace Brigade's own boat.
Mm-hmm.
We were using a boat which had been hired from the Catholic Church by this non-government organization that we were accompanying, which had some church connections. And we were traveling by river, and we came to a point where one river branched off from the big river, a smaller river, and we turned into the smaller river. And at the point between the two rivers, suddenly we noticed there were some armed men.
Right.
But the uniforms they were wearing were not those of the Colombian army. You needed to know your uniforms.
Right.
In Central America also, it paid to know your uniforms. I originally thought that guerrillas went around in jeans and T-shirts, but I found quite the opposite. They go around in uniforms.
That's right.
And so you need to know, wherever you are, you need to know your uniforms. Anyway, we saw a group of men in uniform who gave a loud whistle. And our boatman, without any instructions from us, turned immediately towards the bank.
Yep.
He knew that it paid to obey in those circumstances.
Yes.
And the officer among the group came down to the bank, and he held out his hand to help each one of us. The elderly priest, who was the representative of the non-government organization who we were accompanying, and another woman and myself, who were two Peace Brigades people.
Yes.
And he helped each one of us out, and he said, "Welcome to the territory."
Right.
And he said, "I'm Lieutenant so-and-so."
Yes.
He said, "Would you like to present yourselves?"
Yes.
So we did. And he said, "Oh, and would you mind telling me what mission brings you to these parts?"
Mm.
So we told him, and he said, "That's wonderful. All projects which help the people are very much favoured by us."
Right.
And he then helped us to go back into our boat.
Right.
Meanwhile, some of his men had been talking to our boatman, and we never heard what had been said in that conversation.
Mm.
So we continued. Later, We were camped by a riverbank where we'd spent the night, and a man on a horse in guerrilla uniform, but with a big sort of Mexican cowboy type hat,
right,
came cantering past, and the horse must have been a mare because there was a little foal running alongside.
Right.
And he took off his big Mexican hat, and he waved it at us, and he said, "Buenos dias, good morning." Mm-hmm. So we said "Buenos dias" back to him, of course. And the next occasion when we met them was we were in a large village on the bank of the main river. And this was a big get-together of a lot of different organizations who'd just actually been to see, to do an inspection tour of a village that had been burnt down by the paramilitaries.
Yes.
The paramilitaries were the people who did the dirty work for the army. The army was mainly able to avoid doing dirty work, not always, but mainly in Colombia, because the paramilitaries did it for them.
Now, Eve, what I'm going to do, because we are running out of time, is I think I'll invite you back next year. How does that sound?
Oh, that sounds all right. Yes. It's been quite fun.
Oh, it is fun. Well, it's not fun for me, but I'm sitting, and I'm sure Daryl would agree with me. We're sitting before an Australian icon. And don't tell me.
I wouldn't call it that.
Well, I know you got a British passport, but do you have an Australian passport?
Don't have an Australian passport.
They may deport you, you know.
They might.
They might deport they you might after deport they listen me. To this. That's yes, back to England.
Especially after sitting down in the US consulate.
Many years ago. I think they've forgotten.
Many years ago.
Look, it's been a great honour speaking to you. And look, I speak to a lot of people on this program over many, many years. And sometimes you meet people that I didn't know you from a bar of soap. I think one of our listeners recommended we speak to you. You've shown a lot of courage, but more importantly, you've shown a lot of what I would describe as inner strength, doing things to make the world a better place. And there's very few people who do that decade after decade after decade. And I'm honoured that you've come on the program. And next year, we'll bring you back and we'll continue to talk about your experiences. And it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much, Eva Scuff.
Eve, Eva, in the nursing home where I live, yes. Evelyn.
Evelyn.
Yes, that's all my right. institutional
so,
name.
So if I come and visit you for a cup of tea, I'll have to ask for Evelyn,
yes, not you do
Eva,
that.
Not Eva,
no.
Because they won't know who I'm talking
they won't know
about.
Who you're talking
about. I think it's the white mouse. You know. Thank you very much. Thank you, Daryl. Would you like to wrap up?
Sure, Joe. You have been listening to Radical Australia with presenter Joe Toscano and special guest Eva Scarf here on 3CR Community Radio, 8:55 AM on your dial, online at 3cr.org.au. And this program has been podcasted. Stay tuned now for Brainwaves coming right up.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.